Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Well, hello, and welcome to this Sydney Writers Festival event on secrecy, spying, and government power. I'm Eleanor Horne. I'm delighted to be with you here this evening to facilitate this discussion. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose land we meet and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Well, now to tonight's panel with two distinguished and courageous Australian lawyers whose careers are marked by their recognition that morality should underlie our legal system. Bernard Collaery is a Canberra lawyer, Canberra solicitor and barrister, and also a former ACT Attorney General. Right now, Bernard is facing charges of criminal conspiracy, along with his former client, the intelligence agent Witness K. Despite this, and the threat of jail hanging over him, Bernard has written this book, Oil Under Troubled Water, Australia's Timor Sea Intrigue. This book asks some serious questions about the role of the Australian government in exploiting Timor-Leste's oil resources and the extent to which the Australian government is prepared to go in order to hide its alleged fraud in dealing with this newly emerging nation. Bernard's book details how successive Australian governments have betrayed the Timorese people. But in some parts, it's not as detailed as he would like because the Australian government, just as the book was going to print, charged him under the Intelligence Services Act and used our security laws to stop him from talking about these charges. So the fact that Bernard is on a book tour while the federal government is threatening to jail him and has him under a gag order makes for extraordinary circumstances indeed for our panel. Also joining us this evening is Julian Burnside QC, a Melbourne barrister specialising in commercial litigation, who's also conducted many pro bono human rights cases, particularly in the arena of refugees and asylum seekers. Julian has written several books, including Word Watching, Notes of an Amateur Philologist, and Watching Brief, Law, Rights and Justice. He's a member of the Order of Australia, and in 2014 he was awarded the Sydney Peace Prize. Welcome to you as well, Julian. And once again, welcome to you all. We will, of course, be conducting this discussion within the limits of the law, and I would ask that when we come to questions from the audience, you also respect that. When I say we'll be conducting the discussion within the limits of the law, just within. I'd like to start with you, Bernard, and take you back to that day when this whole saga began, the day that Witness K walked into your legal office. What was your reaction? Well, what can you tell us, I guess, about that first meeting and how it affected you?
Not much. When you look across 40, 50 years of law practice and life, I had a sense it was a life-changing moment. And you would have to delve into my own youth growing up, my own service for our country, and my deep involvement with East Timor, because I had been the legal advisor to the resistance for many years. I had lived and travelled with the Timorese leadership. I'd spent a lot of time in Timor after the devastation, and I could not believe the treachery I was hearing. That was my reaction. I found it unbelievable, one of the more unbelievable events of my life. I can't refer to the facts.
Can you tell us anything about the advice that this intelligence officer was seeking?
in Canberra, there is a community of probably at the moment about 20,000 persons who fit the description of persons within the intelligence agencies. They have all the same things as we do, birth, deaths, marriages, and they are a community that may need legal advice. And Witness K came to me with approval, and I saw him with approval.
Just to be clear on this, you didn't seek this intelligence officer out, did you? The visit with you was first cleared with the relevant defence and intelligence authorities. It was perfectly legal for him to come and seek legal advice from you.
Oh, indeed. 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 Julian will refer to our first CAB rule. We don't turn people away because we don't like what they tell us, and we have to show moral courage at times.
And more fundamentally, it is really important that every person who has a legal problem should be able to get legal help.
Now, Julian, I will come to you because, as we know, Bernard is barred from speaking about the issue at the centre of the court case that he was bringing for the East Timorese to the Court of Arbitration, a fraud case against the Australian government. But happily for us, you are not barred. So can you please set the scene for us and describe your reaction when you first heard that allegation that the Australian government had put its intelligence services into action to bug the cabinet offices of the Timorese government during its negotiations with Australia over an oil treaty?
I was horrified when I heard the facts. But before I go to that, can I just mention something about your acknowledgement of country? It's impossible in Melbourne, certainly, to go to any public event without hearing an acknowledgement of the traditional owners of the land we meet on, blah, blah, blah. But you never hear them say that our ancestors took the land from them and caused them immense harm. And then we redoubled that harm by taking their children from them. And now Aborigines are seen in Australia as a ruined group. Maybe we should have a look and see if we could be part of the problem. But back to your question. I forgot what the question was.
you're telling us, were you shocked when you first heard that allegation?
I really was shocked because the simple fact is that the criminals who did the bugging got away with it, and they're being protected, and they're being protected by prosecuting the people who exposed the fraud.
A lot of people would say, certain foreign policy observers anyway, would say, look, everyone spies. What's the difference here?
I think the difference is that spies are not usually prosecuted. If they're found out, they would be prosecuted. Everyone knows Alexander Downer's position in relation to this. Alexander Downer is probably the most guilty of the people who are involved in the whole episode.
He was foreign minister at the time.
He was foreign minister at the time, and he now works for Woodside, who were the great beneficiaries of the fraudulent bugging of the East Timorese cabinet. And the fact that we bugged the East Timorese cabinet office is unbelievable. And the fact that we are prosecuting the people who sought to expose this in an international court is beyond belief. It really makes you wonder. It really makes you wonder. Who's in charge in this country.
Perhaps I could add something within the law. Witness K received written approval to take, among other possible steps, private legal proceedings. Australia was bound by international treaty to submit to international arbitration if were there to be a dispute over a treaty. What's not publicly appreciated is that Witness K had approval to take private legal action. The Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague does extremely sensitive arbitrations where matters that require in-camera confidences, such as identities and techniques of intelligence services, are and were protected. All of those steps were taken. Every step necessary to protect matters was taken. It was a far more secure tribunal than any court or tribunal in Australia, simply because the whole proceedings were secret. No one revealed the witness K issue. No one revealed the arbitration going on between Timor-Leste and Australia, but Bob Carr and Mark Dreyfus issued a media release saying that Timor-Leste had complained of espionage. That blew me out of the water. It exposed my staff, my law practice, to what's known as algorithmic combing. It meant that any foreign power finding out that would start work on our systems, would start work on any system possible that relates to East Timor, and it blew the whistle. And what the public aren't appreciating is that it was Australia blew the whistle on itself and exposed my client, my law practice, my staff to that kind of attention that we would get from foreign powers.
Bernard, I also want to ask you, you write in your book that you fear that we as Australians are losing the values that so many Australians fought to defend in World War II. You dedicate your book to your father. Tell us about the significance of that dedication.
Well, I mean, I'm 76 and I grew up in the shadow of the war. I recall that in my primary school, there were eight of us who'd lost their fathers. And we were growing up with the belief, said to us by, I guess I was young, Chifley, Menzies, I think, that we were going to build an exemplary society. We were going to dam every river and we were going to solve diphtheria and polio. And I grew up in the sense that the state was moral, ethical, and we were building a new society where torture and the things that we'd lost our fathers for would never happen again. And I can't tell you, and I can't tell everyone here, and thank you so much for coming, the depth of the treachery, because I can't speak about my own background fully for you to understand how treacherous it was for what I can't talk about to have happened.
Well, let's fast forward now to the 2013 police raid, speaking of acts of treachery, on your and Witness K's home and offices. Now, I'm just going to explain a little bit about this raid first. So the raid was very strategically timed. It took place a matter of hours after Bernard had left the country for The Hague to argue that case for the Timorese government that Australia had engaged in fraud in negotiating that oil treaty. The raid meant that the Australian government now had all your notes and all your documents, and on top of that, confiscated Witness K's passport, so now you no longer had your key witness. What was your reaction when your office called you to tell you about that raid?
My office didn't call me. My assistant banged on my bedroom door and said, ASIO have been in our office all day and they've taken our brief. Our staff were all in, bar our clerk, who was the one bailed up in these proceedings, where she wasn't given a copy of the alleged search warrant.
So you had one junior staff member there in your office?
Yes, they took her mobile phone, they made her leave the door open when she went to the Lou, you know, all of those things happened to her, good young woman. But our brief were taken. We were due to appear. And one of the most extraordinary things of my life occurred, because no one ever appears before a court and says, well, Your Honours, we don't need to say anything because they can all tell you what our arguments are. They've got our brief. They've seized our brief. It was an extraordinary moment. And in the International Court later, when we took proceedings against Australia, I recall the Russian judge shaking his head. I couldn't get over that. And so they went down 15-1, the only one, of course, that voted against us was Justice Callanan, who'd recently retired from the High Court, a Queensland judge from Queensland Bar. He thought that the paper shouldn't be returned to us, etc., etc. But, there is a rather poignant aspect to it, because I got the staff together, and Sir Elihu Lauterpack, who led our team, an eminent international lawyer, always said, "Bernard, will you book the Bel Air on the coast there at The Hague? Let's get windows facing the sea." Well, that's where my father's plane is.
Now, Julian, like Witness K, Bernard had got approval to conduct these international proceedings from the appropriate Australian authorities. Does our government actually have the power to raid the offices of a lawyer in an opposing case?
I'm not sure whether they have the power. What matters is that they did it and that no one is allowed to talk about it. Well, you're not allowed to talk about it. We can. I think it's very interesting that we've referred repeatedly to Witness K. Does anyone know his name? I don't. And thinking about Witness K, I've recently met a bloke called Witness J. Witness J, who has been round to my place a number of times, and we've shared a bottle of wine several times. Witness J was secretly charged, secretly tried, and secretly jailed in the ACT.
By the federal government?
By the federal government, yeah. He had worked for ASIS, as I've worked out. He's never told me that. He's never told me his actual name. But the fact that a person can disappear from the community because of the federal government, the fact that a person's identity can be hidden by the government after having done criminal acts at the request of the federal government is very frightening. It puts us one step short of not the sort of government we want.
Julian, staying with you, Bernard's been charged under the Intelligence Services Act and he's been silenced under the national security laws, which were brought in the context of terrorism. Mm. Just how much power do Australia's terrorism and security laws give an Australian government?
Too much. I mean, does he look like a terrorist? Does he sound like a terrorist? Read the book. He doesn't sound like a terrorist to me. I've known Bernard for a number of years. I don't think he's a terrorist. And if the anti-terror legislation enables the government to silence someone like Bernard, well, then it's gone far too far. I learned most of what I know about this, not only from reading the book, but by what Andrew Wilkie said in the Senate in June 2018. And it's really worth getting. Just Google it. Under parliamentary privilege, he said, blah, blah, blah. March 2002, when Foreign Minister Alexander Downer withdrew Australia from the maritime boundary jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice and the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea because he didn't dare let any independent umpire determine where the maritime border should be. The Howard government then had the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, ASIS, install listening devices in East Timor's ministerial offices to eavesdrop on East Timor's deliberations and put Australia in a vastly superior negotiating position. In effect, Downer, and by implication Australia, one of the richest countries in the world, forced East Timor, the poorest country in Asia, to sign a treaty which stopped them obtaining their fair share of the oil and gas revenues, and that's simply unconscionable. That was said in Parliament, which is why I'm allowed to say it now, why we're allowed to know it now. At the end of his observations, he said, "The bottom line is that spying on East Timor was indeed illegal and unscrupulous. Although it was the Howard government's initiative, the crime has subsequently been covered up by all governments ever since, and now this government wants to turn the former ASIS officer and his lawyer into political prisoners. That's what happens in a pre-police state, where instead of royal commissions, they lock up people who more likely deserve the Order of Australia."
There you go. So, Bernard, at the time of the 2013 raids, the government did warn you that you were now liable for prosecution. It waited 5 years, and then in 2018 the axe fell. Why do you think that the then Attorney General Christian Porter waited until then?
It's very hard to know. I think it's best we don't look for conspiracies and vindictiveness. I think it was a young attorney wanting to put his hand to something that was newsworthy. Dare I say, I was a senior lawyer. He'd been a relatively junior prosecutor in Perth. He was from the West, with all that goes with that.
Hope and, no one's from Perth in the audience.
Well, you've only got to look at some recent High Court cases, particularly the bond money case and a few judgments relating to the WA government. But putting that aside, I think that he wanted to make a name for himself, and I'm pleased to say he did.
Now, Julian, Christian Porter does say that, and I'm going to quote him here, that this was an independent decision by the DPP, the Department of Public Prosecutions. Your reaction?
Crap.
Okay, I'm going to come straight back to you, Vernon.
Yes.
If Andrew Wilkie, who we heard Julian reading there, had not told us, the public, about this criminal prosecution against you, do you think we would have known?
I think Witness K and I would have followed Witness J.
Mm.
I'm sure of it. I think they were determined to jail us. And I should tell you, I was the Attorney General and Minister for Corrective Services at one stage. I had a tip-off that the police had rung our local jail and said, we're going to have two high-profile people perhaps tonight because Andrew had issued a pre-speech media release. And I didn't know that, and the government had got onto it and were probably shaping up to take Witness K and I into custody, and that didn't happen.
Thank goodness.
And can I just say at this point, it's all credit to you that you've stood up and made a big fuss about it.
Thank you.
Now, Julian, I want to quote the former Attorney General, Christian Porter, again to you on the secrecy issue. He says it's not terribly unusual that parts of trials would be held in secret. Is this just routine?
It's true that it is not uncommon for little bits of trials to be kept secret. The names of particular witnesses, especially in the family law area, sometimes a little bit more than that. When there's very good reason. I cannot think of any good reason except to protect people like Alexander Dana. And the question is whether he deserves to be protected.
You both warn of the dangers of the secrecy issue in relation to justice. I'll stay with you, Julian. What is so dangerous about secrecy in the law?
If the legal process is hidden, then no one in the community is able to know how it works or whether it works fairly. You know, justice that's hidden is justice that's denied. You simply cannot do it.
And Bernard, you are fighting the Canberra judgment last year that your case would be heard in secret. You're appealing that, and I think the appeal's being heard in about a month. What are your worst fears if you lose that case and your trial is heard in secret?
Well, I think either way it'll go to the High Court.
Mm.
Government lawyers have a penchant for testing legislation, and I think there's some debate as to whether certain provisions in the national security legislation are constitutional, and I think they'd be inclined, properly instructed, to appeal a decision that goes against them. And I don't have to be properly instructed to say we'll appeal any decision that goes against us. can I add to something Julian said? Professor Grayling talks now about what's happened in our democracies, and he calls it now elective dictatorship. And I am blown away by the fact that what's happening to me is happening. I can't believe that we've got a working democracy when the rule of law is trampled on. And, you know, constitutional lawyers say that we should have a representative democracy. You should be conveying your views to your political representatives. They should be reflecting them in Parliament. You have the sovereignty. The people have the sovereignty in our form of constitution. The people should be holding the sovereignty, and our representatives should be delivering our message. They're not. The executive, successive governments have run away and are telling us prescriptively how our country is to be run. We've gone off the rails. I think Grayling is right. So I think what's happening to Kay and myself is symptomatic of some wider malaise.
Bernard, I want to ask you what effect this trial, these charges are having on you and your family.
Well, there's a lot of karma in this. For years and years and years, I have been telling clients facing what they perceive to be unjust prosecutions to not wake up angry, to deal with your anger, your bitterness, don't take it out on your family. There's a high risk that, you know, your family will disintegrate if you can't keep your act together. And there I am now, having to try and practice what Julie and I have said to generations of persons accused and persons in what they perceive to be unfair civil law situations. So the first thing is I have to tell myself in the middle of the night when I wake up angry, calm down. And I think I often think when I go to court and know I'll be in the dock of my own court, how surreal and unreal it is. And can I tell you what happened in Cambridge? See, I spent some years in Cambridge preparing the case on and off commuting. There was a time when we had to find a name for Witness K. It was, of course, after the raid, and after it became clear that our government was hunting us, hunting lawyers, doing their job. And do you want to know why we chose the name K? Most of us have read Kafka. We didn't say anything. And at our first procedural meeting with Australia, we suggested to them with straight faces, well, perhaps we could just use a letter. I read the transcript again a couple of days ago, and the Australians nodded and said, OK.
At least you're having some fun
so
with it.
So it's Witness Kafka.
But as a lawyer, has this destroyed your practice?
Yes.
Will you be able to set up again?
Not in Canberra. I think given the oppression, given the things you're reading, public servants talking about preparing for war, given the hunting down of journalists and whistleblowers on less important issues, given the hunt going on in our national capital, the public service people, men and women who are paying their childcare fees and bringing up children, they will not be coming to my office, and I can understand it. And I think I'm not getting many briefs because people properly believe I'm too busy on my own defence. So they've utterly ruined my practice, yes.
And that is the consequence of the government wanting to protect the criminals. It's outrageous.
Well, Julian, the government, of course, insists, I can barely say this with a straight face, that it's provided legal protection for whistleblowers. Now, yeah. Of course, it does seem contradictory that it also prosecutes them in court, not only Bernard and Witness K, but, of course, the McBride case, the Boyle case. I think it was only a couple of days ago, actually, that the Boyle case, the DPP, did drop some charges, but he still faces life in prison. I mean, what protection do these whistleblower laws provide?
They provide theoretical protection for people who expose wrongdoing at relatively high levels, but the fact is that the governments hate the whistleblower laws, and the way they're enforced is just not consistent with what they're intended to achieve.
Are there any circumstances when whistleblowers should be prosecuted?
I can imagine some circumstances where whistleblowers should be prosecuted. I don't want to go into what those circumstances are, just in case.
And I mean, there's a 2016 review of the whistleblower laws, and apparently the Morrison government has accepted many of those recommendations. Does that give you hope that they might strengthen them?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, all right. Bernard.
Morrison will get his advice from God, and it will not be useful.
Now, Bernard, as we discussed, you're appealing the decision to hold parts of your trial in secret. We now have a new Attorney General, Michaela Cash, and many Australian legal bodies are lobbying her to just drop this case altogether. Do you hold out any hope that she might?
Michaela's from the West.
Julian, do you think there's any hope the government will drop this case?
I hadn't thought of that as a reason. But no. I mean, Michaela Cash does not inspire confidence in anyone who thinks.
Bernard, I want to ask you about the context of your book's release. The government is prosecuting you for allegedly revealing secrets. It's going to enormous trouble to make sure nobody hears about it, not that it's working. Is you releasing this book putting you in more danger?
Yes, because the summons has arrived after its release. I mean, I assume they got into the cloud and penetrated the systems at the publishers. I want to say one thing. Melbourne Uni Press upheld the great traditions of university publication and of liberal democratic thought. It was with another potential publisher who backed out and was only too glad for the manuscript to go to Melbourne University Press. And
And you're not prepared to name that publisher?
No, but happily, in one sense, Louise Adler left Melbourne Uni Press, Nathan Hollier took over, and you can work it through Google, but Nathan brought the manuscript with him and they published. And it's probably one of the most important events in university publishing, not in terms of academe maybe, but it was a university expressing liberal democratic thought, and full marks to that university. It's not mine, I'm from Sydney Uni. It's not beyond the capacity of the government to prosecute that university, perhaps. You know, they had to get their own legal advice. Of course, I spoke to my peers, but... and you should also know that because of the 10-hour difference, I was able to go to Emma Alberici in London, who had covered the Iraq War Special Forces inquest I had done a couple of years before in the United Kingdom, and she had covered it very conscientiously because there were many secret, sensitive aspects of that hearing because the war was going on in Iraq. And I rang her, and she subsequently ran Late Line that very night because of the time difference. So, and it's very important for people to know in the whistleblowing sense. And in the sense, speaking to some of the lawyers present, in the sense of Lange and the ABC, that is the implied right to freedom of expression, that I only went out on this issue after our brief was seized. Only after our brief was seized. We were sorely tempted when Mrs. Karen Dreyfus revealed it, but Melbourne Uni rode the rattler and published, and wonderful, wonderful thing for them to do because I thought all my work was gone.
I think it's worth mentioning that Nathan brought the book with him, brought the manuscript with him from Monash University, and I mention that simply because I went to Monash.
Now, I want to ask you both whether, I mean, obviously you're worried about the freedoms that we take for granted. We've been discussing that. But do you fear that Australians are too complacent about the state of our democracy?
I think Australians are too easily fooled into accepting the word of the Murdoch press, dare I say it, because what happens is that you get dishonest politicians like Alexander Downer or Scott Morrison, and they say stuff which is reported as if it's true, and the Australian public, who've got far more to think about than whether or not a politician is lying to them, and that leads democracy off the track. I think that's a real problem.
Bernard?
Yes, I agree. I should have added that, as some of you know, that MR Alberici fell out with the Turnbull government, but I mean, Emma and other ABC journalists are named in my prosecution, and I fear for them if I go down. They haven't finished with us yet.
This is a question that I just can't not ask. Given the key role that former Attorney General Christian Porter played in your prosecution, how did you feel, and I'll ask you both because I'm not sure that Bernard wants to answer this one, but how did you feel when he cited protecting the rule of law as a reason for not standing down when he was facing those rape allegations? I'll start with you, Julian, because I think Bernard's reluctant to answer this one.
I was not impressed by Christian Porter as Attorney General. I don't think he understands the law at all. What more do I need to say? And the fact that he's bringing a defamation action now against the ABC and the journalist strikes me as truly bizarre. He's someone who simply does not like the truth being told.
If you have questions, now is the time. And I think there's someone here. I can just see someone here at this microphone.
Yeah, hello. My name is Corey. Ironically, I'm a criminal lawyer from the West. The whole prosecution has made me been ashamed to be Australian in many ways. And I have a friend at the Commonwealth DPP who asked me to ask this question if I was given the chance, Bernard. And she wanted me to ask, and it's something that Julian touched on. You've acted for Witness K. We'd like to know, as defence lawyers, where are witnesses A to J?
Corey, good to see you again.
Thank you.
I didn't put him up to that, but I met Corey. I can say this. I was clearly an approved lawyer for intelligence personnel. Publicly raiding my office, publicly disclosing that I might be acting for someone alleged to be a spy, was an appalling misadventure, because I was in The Hague. We didn't know about the raid. Our clerk was held incommunicado, but the world knew before we were asleep. So our practice was left open and vulnerable to algorithmic combing. People understand algorithmic combing? I mean, the government used it in robo-debt to comb out alleged judgment debtors. And foreign agencies and our own comb every record possible to identify people. So our client base, everything was left open for 19 hours after our clerk was hunted off the premises. It was a profound potential security breach by Australia.
Perpetrated by the government.
Perpetrated by the government.
Just before I go, there's one other thing I'd just like to mention as a statement. You mentioned Downer's involvement as a beneficiary of this crime. What about Ashton Calvert?
I didn't mention Downer or Ashton, but...
guilty.
Him over there. Corey? May have.
And Ashton Calvert is not the only other one. But Downer, it all came from Downer and Howard. Really, I mean, Downer was foreign minister. He was the one who was in a position to say, go ahead or stop. But there are public servants right down the line whose involvement is discreditable. And by the way, it's good to see that there are lawyers from the West who are okay.
There's a lady down the front here.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you, Julian and Bernard, for your courage, your decency and your humanity. I feel deeply for you in your anguish, Bernard, and wish you well. In a recent conversation with a reliable friend, a credible person who is not a rumour monger, I was informed that there are moves afoot in government to prevent people who have retired from the public sector blowing a whistle in their retirement, and if they were to do so, steps would be taken to not allow them access to their superannuation. Have you heard of this? Would you like to comment? Sounds like the sort of thing government would do nowadays.
I've heard of that. I've heard of that, yes. But I don't know. I can guess who would be proposing that, but I shouldn't. A zealot.
Julian, have you heard of it?
I hadn't heard of that. It's sort of not surprising, but it is disappointing because, well, it depends. You've got to specify the particular facts that you're imagining. But the fact that a public servant can learn certain facts during their time in the public service and be exposed to the risk of financial destruction if ever they speak is shocking. That's not what Australian democracy is supposed to be about.
The lady down here.
So, Bonoiti, Haunia Naran Nik, and Tinan Lima Bakotuk Hausar Visui Adili. So, I'm very rusty, but that's the beautiful Timorese language, Tetum. Just introduced myself, and I used to work there several years ago. My question is whether, and I think I know what your answers would be, whether you think there's ever a situation where the kind of behaviour that the Australian government displayed is justified, if it's my house versus your house, you know, is there any way it's ever justified? And also perhaps your thoughts about whether you think this shows the falsehood of Australia's opinion of itself as an underdog in the world is really something that's created to make us feel like it's okay to do this maybe, or to cover up this sort of behaviour compared to where we really sit compared to our neighbours?
Perhaps I could tackle that, Eleanor. Our reputation in the Pacific is at an all-time low. The foreign policy in the region has been disastrous. We have rubbed the Samoans, we've rubbed the atoll states the wrong way over climate change. We've endlessly rubbed the Indonesians and patronised them, and we do things to the Timorese. But let me say that Timor was an engaging ally, welcoming our defence services. I mean, without our defence services and the NGOs and the religious orders from Australia, our reputation would be blown right away. They've redeemed us in some respects, but throughout the region, Australia is now distrusted, and particularly the atoll states over climate change, our non-reaction, our coal thing. I think there could be no justification in using in the intelligence services against allied states, and it is counterproductive. You've got to remember, Australia and Timor at relevant times were in what lawyers call a fiduciary relationship. We were running a joint venture. There was a zone of cooperation in the Timor Sea. If we did those things between boardrooms of fiduciary partners, it's a criminal offence in Australia. If that happened in Collins Street, it'll be a criminal offence. I didn't say where it would be, you might want to guess. But I can't see how you can justify under the Intelligence Services Act, because that set down the laws, how you could willy-nilly simply say, we'll all country spy and we will do those things. The Intelligence Service Act sets standards, and I examined those standards as a lawyer, and I gave certain advice as to whether those standards had been adhered to. And so it's not a question of all country spy. Why do we want to join that? The prosecution of Kay and myself has sent the Russians and the Chinese laughing. It's prevented us now from criticising them. It's been a gift to our adversaries, an absolute gift to them.
Thank you very much. My name is Ian Enright, and I wanted first, if I may, to thank both of you for the extraordinary good that you both do, and Bernard, for the unimaginable courage which you must bring every day. I've practiced law for 40 years, and my family has practiced law in Australia for 150 years. My ancestors and I would be, and I am, appalled at the depths to which the rule of law and its absence has sunk in Australia. My simple question is, what does a citizen do to attempt to restore the rule of law in Australia? I'll give that two pieces of brief context, if I may. Everyone will be aware, it's a matter of public record, that a number of cabinet ministers, Dutton, Hunt, Tudge, Tehan, and two others whose names escape me, have been committed for contempt of court. Three of them, in fact, refused to appear before the Victorian Court of Appeal in response to their summons. So the absence of the rule of law is rife among the cabinet. The normal recourse would be to look to the calibre, independence and quality of the Attorney General. We've moved from George Brandis, whom you wouldn't trust in a running down case, to Christian Porter, a man with an utter absence of ethics. And now we have an Attorney General who's worked for a year or two in a provincial commercial firm. I leave you with my question. Thank you.
I agree with the underlying proposition in the question. I think what Australians can do is to be concerned. We need to be concerned about the problem. The difficulty, I think, is that most Australians are much more concerned about meeting their mortgage or rent obligations, looking after what their kids are doing at school, all of that. They're not interested in abstract concepts like the rule of law, but this is a society in which we are prosecuting the whistleblowers in order to protect the guilty, and that ought to trouble everyone. And I'm so pleased to see so many people here tonight to hear that message.
Do you want to comment on that one, Bernie?
No, it's fine.
Hello, I'm a first-year law student, and I'm just curious if the prosecution of whistleblowers continues into the future. Do you have any advice for those who are wanting to enter the field of law in your specific field? And if they're ever approached with such a case?
People ask me why I became a lawyer, particularly first-year law students, and I get that occasionally. And the honest answer is that when I was a child, we had to milk twice on Christmas Day. And I knew that I wasn't going to become a dairy farmer, right? That's the honest answer. But my usual answer is to support the rule of law.
And can I add to that? I think that most people have an instinct for justice, the importance of justice. We may not understand it. It's a very difficult concept. But I think that's one of the great reasons for becoming a lawyer, is to pursue justice. And what is happening to Bernard and Witness K is unjust. And most people recognise that. There's an interesting test for the meaning of justice. Imagine it's the last day of the school holidays. Mum's at her wit's end because the kid's been rotten all day. She's in the kitchen cooking dinner, and she hears a crash in the sitting room, which is next door. She rushes in, the kids have disappeared, but her most valuable, most precious, most loved vase is smashed to bits on the hearth. And here we go in two directions. First, she just knows that it's the young boy who did it. She finds him, punishes him, sends him to bed without dinner. As it happens, he did do it. Second alternative, she goes to each of the children in turn, asks neutral questions calculated to work out what went on, puts it together as carefully and dispassionately as possible, comes to the conclusion it's the young boy who did it, finds him, punishes him, sends him to bed without dinner. As it happens, he didn't do it. Which of those is closer to your sense of justice? And if it's the second, ask the kid.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, unless someone gives me a signal that we can extend, but I'll go to this gentleman here.
It's Jeff Lee from the Australia East Timor Association. I'd like to acknowledge the presence here tonight of Luciano Concio, the current and incoming Consul General for Timor-Leste in Australia, who's sitting up there. And he's quite happy to chat and meet people at the end of the session. Bernard and I have known each other for quite a while. When this court case came up, not only did he have to deal with his family and his traumas, but when I spoke to him on the phone, he said, if you're going to ring me, they'll be bugging it. If you're going to email me, they'll be monitoring it. In other words, they've turned him into a leper, where two-thirds of his friends are too scared to ring or email him in case their own ASIO files get expanded tremendously. But leaving that aside, Sister Susan Connolly has already collected 100,000 signatures in an online petition to drop the charges for Bernard and Witness K. Everyone in this room, if Bernard could remember the URL, should go there and sign it tonight. The ABC doesn't cover pickets we hold at the 16 or 18 appearances Bernard's made already. They're trying to exhaust him by dragging him into court every Monday morning, virtually. But their solidarity movement are still active outside the courtroom every time down in Canberra that it goes ahead. We've given up here because the ABC have been intimidated enough that they won't even cover our pickets down at Benton Bligh Street outside the Attorney General's office. I've just got two quick things to finish on. Bernard, the Justinian column in the Saturday paper said that Bookshelves Brander's head lawyer left his office and went to work for the Royal Commission into the Building Unions, got paid $870,000 for 6 months' work, and then popped up under Christian Porter as the new DPP. Do you think that's enough distance for somebody to say, for Christian Porter to say that the DPP in Australia is independent from the Attorney General? And my second comment, having read your book, is why are you the only one in Australia who knew that the Australians ripped off $20 billion in revenue extra on top of the oil and gas money with the helium plant they built in Darwin? Why are you the only one I know in all the books I've read on Timor to reveal that in public? Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. We are now at time. I'm not getting a signal as to whether we should extend, but perhaps we can have one more question.
Thank you both. I want to echo everyone else's comments about you. I've got so many questions I could ask you, but one thing that ties it all together, something you said, Bernard, about the Malays, and the fact that there is this, let me look at my notes because I want to make sure I get it right for you. You referred to a wider malaise. You stated that there are elected representatives who are supposed to be defending our views, but they're not. Instead, they're acting like dictators. What I want to ask you is, if they're not representing our views, are they representing the views of, whose views are they representing? Obviously, I can allude to, you know, the bigger business, and is it the highest bidder that they represent? And what does that represent? What does that mean for you in your case? Can you feel confident, both of you? Are you confident that our justice system, our high court, our courts, our judges are not similarly influenced by those highest bidders? Because I'm making a documentary about Lebanon. I've been 5 years in researching it. You know the state of Lebanon today, all because of corruption and the intermingling of business, high business and politics. And Lebanon now is a failed state. Are we on the same track? Obviously, we're far from it, but, you know, this is where us as citizens need to stand up and hear more from you. And why aren't we hearing about about this, more from you guys. What's happening?
Well, firstly, there is really, so far as I'm concerned, when I look at the legislation passed post 9/11, there is no carefully working, scrutinising opposition in our federal parliament. That's the first thing. Because how did those 2004 laws that I'm being subjected to get through? Why wasn't it picked up that they could be used on me and Witness K? What was the opposition doing at the time? And so our parliamentary system is a failure. There's a failure of democracy, and there are groups now in power alternately exchanging the baton. It is an elective dictatorship, because you wake up in the morning and you are told we are going to collect $20 million by robo-debt systems. You're told that. You're not consulted about it, and the algorithm is used, and then we have whatever it is, 2,000 suicides and all the rest. There's no personal responsibility of our elected politicians. No one takes responsibility. And as Julian says, as Ian Enright just said, there is a total contempt for rule of law. In some countries, there'd be a revolt. But we're prudent and we use an abundance of caution. You here are cautious people. We're not prone to revolt. But there'll be a moment. There'll be a moment, I regret to say. There'll be a moment when we've had enough. We need to have a reform process.
I just want to say, but where are the judges? Where are the lawyers? There's so many lawyers. If there aren't, I mean, there's 10 lawyers for every citizen in Australia. So where are they? Why aren't they all standing behind you?
Well,
we have two
of them here tonight.
Can I hop in on that? First, I've never encountered any judges in the Australian system who are less than fully conscientious and honest. And there are plenty of their judgments I disagree with, but I've never doubted their honesty. So I think we're very well served by our judicial system. That said, I think our government is corrupt and dishonest, and the opposition is not much better. So there's the problem.
A positive and a negative. Would you please put your hands together and thank our wonderful guests this evening?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.